thank you all for coming, and thank you to those who are watching us via live stream today. My name is Amanda Sauls, and I'm this year's president of the Texas Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is a national network comprised of conservative and libertarian attorneys, judges, scholars, and students. And as a student chapter, the Texas Federalist Society strives to promote freedom, federalism, and the rule of law. And we do so through facilitating debate and discussion within our law school community. Today, we're thrilled to be co-sponsoring with the National Federalist Society organization a talk with UT's professor Tara Smith from the Department of Philosophy, who will be discussing the conceptual confusions in the way that we discuss the freedom of speech. Without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to our Vice President of Speakers, Ashley Terrazas, who will introduce our esteemed speaker.
Professor Tara Smith is a professor of philosophy here at the University of Texas. A specialist in moral and political philosophy, she turned her attention to philosophical issues in the law about a dozen years ago, focusing primarily on questions surrounding judicial review. Her book, Judicial Review in an Objective Legal System, was published by Cambridge in 2015. Other articles primarily concern religious freedom and the rule of law. And her most recent article, The Free Speech Vernacular, was published in the fall 2007 edition of the Texas Review of Law and Politics. In her broader philosophical work, Professor Smith has published books and articles spanning such subjects as individual rights, the roots of morality, moral virtues, justice in everyday life, forgiveness, pride, moral perfection, egoistic friendship, the nature of objectivity, and the value of sports to the serious fan. Please help me in welcoming Professor Tara Smith.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much to the chapter for having me, and thank you all for coming and for traipsing across campus, I know in some cases. I've frequently spoken at FedSox before, but never here at my own campus, which feels a little odd. But I have to say, when you walk in and you see this, it really makes you feel strange. It's like we need music or something. It has these background expectations as if we're going to rock, and it's just another dry academic, you know, sorry. So. I also can't see you, though, because of this, which is, depending on how it goes, that can be good or bad. But I generally like to see you, so excuse me for having to do that a lot. Okay. Does everyone have a handout? There was a single-page handout that I hope you got. I'll make some reference to that at different points. It's not essential, but I think it can be helpful. So I'm going to jump right in. The name of the title of the talk is The Free Speech Vernacular. Conceptual confusions in the way we speak about speech. It sounds like something a philosopher would do, doesn't it? In debates over the proper boundaries of freedom of speech, we're naturally alert to the meaning of certain pivotal concepts, such as offensive speech, right, or hate speech, what constitutes incitement, or how far a person's privacy rightfully extends against others' speech. So there are these natural sort of magnetic concepts, and we argue about, well, what is hate speech and so on. Alongside such contested concepts, however, stand peripheral terms whose misuse can be every bit as influential, but whose ramifications tend to go unnoticed. I have in mind such terms as absolute and exception. Because these terms are not associated with particular ideological positions. It's not, for instance, that those who invoke exceptions systematically support more freedom of political speech or less, that they tend to take one position rather than another on campaign finance, that sort of thing. Because there aren't these neat ideological divisions among people who use the terms exception, absolute, we tend to assume that those terms are just neutral tools, part of the debate's infrastructure. But I shall argue that confusions concerning some of these seemingly incidental concepts impede clear thinking about how a legal system should treat speech. Indeed, they often lend a cover of respectability to unjustified restrictions. One question. Is this too loud? It sounds loud to me, but I'm OK in terms of the, everybody, I'm OK? OK, thanks. All right, so what's the plan? And there is an outline on the handout if you wanted to take a quick peek. I'm going to consider four concepts: absolute, exception, censorship, and freedom. I'll begin by offering a few examples of each being misused and briefly explain the errors involved. I'll then address the damage. What harm do such confusions inflict? Why should we care about them? And then finally, I'll turn briefly to the roots of these errors. What underlying beliefs foster these mistakes? While a handful, I think, are at work, today I'll simply focus on one to provoke your reconsidering a much acclaimed friend of free speech, okay? And this is based on a longer paper which, as Ashley said, was recently published in the Texas Review of Law and Politics. So I recommend that you look at that for further elaboration and, you know, just perfect answers to every question that you'll raise later, as we all know. Okay. A few presuppositions, just a little bit more preliminary before we get into it. I'm talking about misconceptions of some of these four concepts, right? Well, obviously, to claim misconceptions, I'm relying on definite ideas of the correct meaning of these four terms. So let me state up front, I believe that the right to free speech is absolute and admits of no exceptions. That censorship consists of government restrictions on an individual's freedom of speech, and that this freedom consists of the absence of others forcibly restricting one's speech. But that's not the thesis of this paper, and I won't offer a direct case for it here. My present aim is the more modest one of conceptual cleanup, to carve these categories that inform our thinking about speech more accurately so as to help us reach valid conclusions about the proper boundaries of free speech. Without expecting you to necessarily agree with those larger views of mine, I do hope to convince you that cleanup is needed because the field of debate is studded with confusions. And while my aims are somewhat modest, the stakes are large. For as long as we labor under blurred conceptual boundaries, we will reach misguided conclusions and consequently protect speech that should not be protected and restrict speech that should not be restricted. Okay, so let's turn to the first pair of concepts, absolute and exceptions. A few examples of how these are commonly misused. And again, I do have more examples in the paper, but just a few. Now, as I cite these, you want to listen for the implicit meanings of these terms, of, you know, whether it's absolute or exception. Just listen to what seems to be the implied meaning of the term as a given figure is using it, okay? So typical is an editorial in The Economist, and I think I've got this on your handout, which, after lauding freedom of speech as the oxygen of democracy, concludes, quote, "So the right to free expression should be almost absolute. Bans on child pornography and the leaking of military secrets, on the deliberate incitement of violence, are reasonable," close quote. The United States Supreme Court has held that the right of free speech is not absolute, since certain restrictions on speech are fine. Excuse me. I've given you a few others on the handout from a couple of law professors, Jeremy Waldron and Eric Hines, but I won't read through those here, okay? In the same vein, people frequently refer to restrictions on libel or incitement as exceptions to free speech. One doesn't have the right to leak classified national security information, so they say exceptions are commonplace. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, while defending free speech, concedes, and this is, quote, and this is, I think, on the handout. So this is Pinker. And I have to say, I like Pinker in general. It pains me a little bit to be critical here because I'm generally an admirer, have a lot of respect for his work, okay? But I think he made a mistake here. So what Pinker says is, it's true that free speech has limits. We carve out exceptions for fraud, libel, extortion, divulging military secrets, and incitement to imminent lawless action, close quote. Okay, so that's a few examples to try to keep in your mind. What's wrong with this picture? What are the confusions in how absolute and exceptions are being used? Now, admittedly, the term absolute, that can have somewhat different meanings in different contexts. When we're, you know, like in metaphysics, I mean, philosophers can definitely, you know, they have definite conceptions of the absolute in certain very specialized areas, but when we're discussing a prescriptive principle, such as rights to free speech, absolute means holding paramount authority within its domain. To say that a principle is absolute means that within its domain, it admits of no exceptions. an absolute ruler, for instance, his rule is unconditional, right? He is not subject to constraints imposed by a constitution. Consider, a lot of people would say, your right to life is absolute. We don't question that when we're reminded that you're not legally free to physically assault people or to steal others' property, right? The right to life does not protect that, yet it is an absolute, meaning, as long as you respect others' rights, your right is sacred. Others are forbidden from infringing it. No exceptions. I have to see you. You are out there. Okay, good. The misuse of this concept absolute frequently confuses strength of authority with scope of authority. Think about Louis XIV, right? Absolute monarch par excellence. He was the textbook case from which many of us learned the concept of absolute rule, absolute monarchy. But now think about it for a minute. Even Louis, absolute monarch though he was the king of France. He wasn't the king of Britain or what? Excuse me. He wasn't the king of Britain or Westphalia or Ethiopia or the Andes, right? Does that mean that we misdescribe his power when we refer to it as absolute? No. His power was absolute, yet it was confined to a bounded domain. In France, his authority was subject to no other, second to none. So my point is, strength of authority is distinct from scope, the range over which authority is valid. And the fact that the right of free speech isn't boundless doesn't mean that it isn't absolute. Okay. So what about apparent exceptions? Legal restrictions on libel, incitement, and so on. Shouldn't the legal system restrict a person engaged in those types of speech? Yes, but not because they constitute exceptions. Rather, as the proper application of the absolute principle of free speech. It's crucial to recognize that a person's freedom of speech never encompassed speech that violates others' rights. The so-called exceptional case is not within a person's legitimate authority to begin with. Think back to Steven Pinker for a minute and the quote I read and that's on the handout from him. Right? He thought of legal limits for fraud, libel, legal restrictions on those. He thought of these as exceptions to free speech. But now let's think about that, right? What would these be exceptions from? From your right to pillage, loot, take from another what's his? These limitations would be exceptions only if one supposed a general right to invade others' rights. But that would make no sense, since it would destroy the whole concept of rights. My point is, it is not an exception to recognize the boundary of one's authority. My neighbor, literally my neighbor, Steve, just 20 minutes north of here in Austin, right? My neighbor, his backyard isn't an exception to my property. The fence between our yards designates the extent of each of our authority, right? So, yes, some speech should be legally restricted, but not as an exception, rather because that is what the absolute principle, properly understood, requires. Okay, so let's turn to the other two terms, the other two concepts, censorship and freedom. Here, my general concern is of concept creep. That these terms have both been extended to encompass an ever wider and more disparate array of perceived transgressions. People commonly these days complain about things such as market censorship. A person's boss tells him he can't wear certain t-shirts, certain messages on his t-shirts at work, and he complains he's being censored. You might recall, there are just a stream of episodes like this, but one from the past year, in Manhattan, I think it was the Shakespeare in the Park last summer, there was a very controversial production of Julius Caesar because people thought it was saying things about Trump or what to do to Trump and so on. So certain sponsors, such as American Express, withdrew their backing of the production, and a lot of people cried, that's corporate censorship, right? Private companies, such as Facebook or Twitter, they bar certain messages from their services, maybe because they're misogynistic or racist or the like. And a lot of people say, oh, they're censoring now, right? And it's not just, oh, you know, us uneducated people who read and react quickly to these kinds of events. A few years ago, when Yale University Press refused to publish, it was publishing a book on the whole Danish cartoons controversy, but it refused to publish in that book the actual images, the cartoons, right? And when the press, Yale University Press, decided to do this, many academics accused it of censorship. British scholar, author Timothy Garton Ash, in a recent manifesto defending pretty wide freedom of speech, advises us to remember, as if, you know, we all know this, we just have to be reminded, remember, he writes, that censorship is exercised by religious organizations, corporations, media owners, criminal gangs, political parties, close quote. In the United States, some years ago, the head of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, blithely declared, quote, there's censorship by ratings, by advertisers, by networks, dot, 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 close quote. A Wall Street Journal, Wall Street Journal columnist about a year ago, this was Holman Jenkins, for those of you who read the journal, he was urging in a column, he was urging Google and Facebook to refrain from, quote, excessively censoring their users, close quote. And since we tend to assume that censorship infringes on a person's freedom of speech, what that freedom is has correspondingly been bloated to amazing proportions. A few examples here. And this first one's a little complicated. Consider the common practice of measuring different nations' freedom of speech by their quantity of speech. What I have in mind is something like this. You're reading a magazine article, and it'll report figures about, let's say, the number of newspapers in a given country, in India or England or wherever, right? The number of newspapers or the number of people who post on Facebook in that country or the number of people who use Twitter, right? They'll refer to these figures and treat them as indicative of the country's freedom of speech. You'll read things saying, well, you'll read things like, a greater percentage of the British use Twitter than Brazilians, therefore Britain has more robust freedom of speech. Assumption. Greater quantity of speech, greater number of papers or readers or tweeters or whatever, right, equals more freedom of speech. But if you pause and think about that for a minute, right, that doesn't hold up. While a high volume of speech is frequently a byproduct of freedom of speech, it's not what it is. They're not one and the same thing, right? If we learned, for example, that a greater percentage of Turks use Twitter than British, we'd think twice before concluding that Turkey enjoys greater freedom of speech, given all that we know about Mr. Erdogan, right? Maybe those people are just more tech savvy, or they happen to like Twitter a lot, or they're more vocal or bold, or they have more to complain about, or whatever. Okay. Another example concerning this expansive notion of freedom. A little over a year ago, right around the time that the Trump administration was taking over, there was a lot of fear expressed in the country about freedom of press speech. And political commentator Bill O'Reilly, you remember Bill, okay? Anyway, Bill. He weighed in that since American media are biased to the left, we don't have a free press anyway. As if freedom of speech and objectivity of speech, bias or lack of bias, right? As if freedom and bias or objectivity were the same thing. Brian Leiter, a very influential law professor at the University of Chicago who had been here before moving on to Chicago, he had been a professor here for several years. Brian Leiter, in a recent piece in the Sydney Law Review, argues basically this. Given that what a lot of people have to say is useless, we should temper our adoration of free speech and not grant it such extensive protection. Leiter argues, quote, there's no free speech in the courtroom, right, where people are subject to rules of evidence, and almost no one thinks that there should be. He goes on to reason, we also accept restrictions on speech in a classroom or in scientific research. Therefore, we're justified in placing more restrictions, legal restrictions, on all speech. Problem here. This relies on a flagrant equivocation between freedom of speech and standards of constructive speech in a particular context. But freedom is not the absence of all standards of critical judgment. It's not the absence of evaluation, right? I mean, you can still talk about, well, is this probative? Is this, what's the logical strength of the thing that she is saying? What's the pedagogical import of the thing that she is saying, right? We can still assess in a courtroom or in a classroom and so on what's being said by all sorts of other measures, but they're not the same as judging the freedom of speech. Again, freedom is not absence of all critical judgment or evaluation. It's the absence of coercion. Your speech is free when it isn't forcibly restricted by other people, forcibly restricted by other people. My larger point, so bearing through these examples, my larger point is simply that people sloppily sling around the phrase freedom of speech to mean several differing things and often inaccurate things. I can't explain all of these different meanings here, but on the handout, you might want to look at it later, I go through about seven, I think, very common confusions of freedom of speech with something else that don't really get to the nature of freedom, okay? So what about the fourth term, censorship? How is that misused in the cases cited? The kinds of, you know, claims that people make, you bar me from Twitter, you're censoring me. Okay. I'm not on Twitter, so maybe I'm not as sensitive to being not censored, but something else. At any rate, how are they using the term censorship in cases like that? Essentially, they're using censorship to designate pressure that results in undesired consequences. I'm censored when others impose unwelcome pressure on me. Now, properly, censorship means government's forceful obstruction of your right to speak. Historically, the term censorship referred to state restriction of thought. A censor was a government employee. There were offices in different countries. You know, people got paychecks for being censors, right? A censor was a government employee who reviewed books, performances, correspondence. He could deny publication, confiscate your newspaper, shut down your theater, put you in jail for saying those things. And this usage isn't simply historical accident that's convenient for Tara's purposes, right? The reason why censorship means exclusively government restriction of speech is twofold. And again, I won't go into depth here, but on the, you know, first, it turns on the recognizing the fundamental difference in kind between the forced and the free, between tools of persuasion and tools of coercion. And second, censorship refers to government restriction of speech because the freedom to speak goes hand in hand with the freedom not to speak and not to support speech or ideas that you disagree with. But if private agents, you know, the owners of a business, the owners of a magazine, the employer who doesn't want the waiters at his pizza place wearing certain t-shirts or whatever, or American Express, be it big, small, or indifferent, right? If a private agent directing his resources according to his beliefs, if what he was doing there could constitute censorship of others, and the government could punish him because he's not supposed to censor people, then his freedom of speech would be erased. If you're compelled to support ideas that you disagree with, your right is neutered. Now, I do want to be clear about something. I don't think this gets enough say in most discussions of freedom of speech, enough play, actually. To say that an action is not censorship, because I'm saying we overuse that term, a lot of stuff that people call censorship isn't. Well, to say that an action is not censorship is not to immunize it from all criticism or all just criticism, all valid criticism, all important criticism. Now, the analysis that I've just given you, I would say Yale University Press, in that example, the book with the Danish cartoons, it wasn't censoring. It has a right to publish what it chooses. But that's just one issue. Was it censorship or not, right? It was, I think, cowardly. It betrayed the ideals of scholarly inquiry. It showed itself unworthy of respect as an academic publisher. What's salient, though, is that the moral way to exercise a right, the right to free speech, and whether or not one possesses that right are, again, two distinct questions. The upshot. Properly, freedom of speech means the absence of others restricting your speech by force. It's not the absence of unpleasant repercussions from your actions. Other people are not obligated to maintain your comfort zone of preferred pressures, those that you regard as tolerable. Freedom of speech is not a feeling marked by the absence of uncomfortables. Okay, let me take a sip of water and move on. Let me turn to the damage then, if you're following on the handout, the outline. I mean, at this stage, I hope one might think, okay, fair enough. But isn't this just word games? I mean, maybe you're just manufacturing much ado about not all that much. What's the harm with misuse of these terms? Well, I think the harm is significant. For starters, it discourages us from carefully examining why certain speech should or shouldn't be protected. When we instead lazily recite, there are always exceptions, nothing's absolute, we weaken our grasp on what the proper boundaries of free speech are, which means we'll police those boundaries in all the more lax and error-prone a way. And this feeds more directly into why this matters. If your right to freedom protects you from four or five different things, because again, we're using that term to mean four or five or six or seven different things, right? It protects you from an unpleasant reaction of other people or poor quality speech. You know, Brian Leiter, he doesn't want people speaking stupidly, right? If your freedom to speech is supposed to protect you from all of that, then there are going to be an awful lot of incursions on people's freedom, right? It's going to be really easy to violate somebody else's freedom of speech, which will invite the government to step in to protect them from that. In other words, this authorizes unjustified government restrictions on speech. To be even more specific, if we misclassify private actions as censorship, the government will forbid individuals from spending their advertising dollars as they choose, or from exercising their editorial judgment and running their magazines, their newspapers, right? In other words, the government will restrict them from exercising their rights. And more broadly, misuses of these concepts give incursions on free speech a good name. When we condemn as censorship actions that are not truly censorship, we make censorship seem not so odious. After all, some such pressures, so-called censorship, exerted by private parties will seem reasonable to people, right? People will often think, as I'm sure some of us have at times, well, gee, why should Twitter be compelled to convey messages that it doesn't want to? Any more than a philosophy journal should be compelled to publish an article that Tara submits, or that the Times should be compelled to publish your letter to the editor, right? If it's all censorship, right, if we throw it all into that loose, capacious cabin, well, then some censorship seems fine, right? The danger, in other words, is that we normalize censorship. And think back to a couple of the examples that I read, right? When a government official, the head of the FCC some years ago, when he declares, again, to quote him, quote, there's censorship by ratings, by advertisers, and so on. Notice what he's doing. He's conveniently saying, don't get mad at the government for censoring. We all censor. It's all the same. That's normalizing. When the Wall Street Journal columnist Jenkins criticizes Google and Facebook for excessive censorship, implying that some would be fine, that's normalizing. I mean, basically what we've got here is a cry wolf phenomenon. And as the historian Robert Darnton observed, quote, if the concept of censorship is extended to everything, it means nothing, close quote. In the end, the damage is that misclassifying these phenomena blurs important differences and emboldens the government to restrict rightful speech. Okay, so I do think our freedom to speak, is what's on the line in these seemingly innocuous debates about terms. So let me say a little bit about the roots of these confusions. Why do people make these mistakes if they are the mistakes that I've portrayed them as? If we're to correct them, it can always be helpful to understand where they're coming from. So what are some of the deeper roots beneath these? Now, ultimately, I think a handful are at work, but I'm not going to talk about all of them here. Today, I'm just going to focus on one, utilitarianism. The ascendancy of its instrumentalist defense of free speech has been particularly corrosive, I think. I've made a note on another stream that feeds this on skepticism on the handout, but again, that's just something, if you want to look at it later, you can. But let's think about utilitarianism for a few minutes. And how many of you, by the way, have read John Stuart Mill, in particular his On Liberty and his chapter in, or simply his chapter in On Liberty on freedom of expression? Has anybody read that? I would think, not as many as I would have thought. Okay. Utilitarianism. First, let's notice how it cuts against the absolutism of free speech. For a utilitarian, nothing is absolute. Every should is contingent on social utility. To reap maximal utility, sometimes you need to restrict speech. So exceptions are a no-brainer. Utilitarianism also abets the confusion of censorship with private sanction. For if social utility is the ultimate aim, then the means by which that's achieved, whether those means are government force or private and voluntary, that's immaterial. Results are all for the utilitarian. How we reach those results, that's secondary. Anything that doesn't maximize the sought results is deemed censorship, bad. Now, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty has been a great aid to the cause of free speech. In some ways. It makes several strong arguments for the value of open dialogue, rigorous debate. And even if you haven't read him directly, I'm sure that I'm going to recite a few of them now. I'm sure some of these will be familiar to you because they are often invoked, and there are a lot of good points that he makes here. He, for example, he explains the benefits of having your views challenged, having to defend one's beliefs. He speaks of free, open exchange and dialogue as helping to keep our convictions alive, understood, rather than just becoming ossified, stale, dogmatic prejudice, right? He discusses the dangers of assuming the infallibility of you, yourself, your views on a topic, without having a loud question, serious challenge to your views. He talks about the many faceted nature of certain truths, which can only come out fully when you have robust open debate, right? He offers a lot of seemingly helpful ammunition for the cause of free speech, but I say seemingly. These blessings, I think, have also been a curse in a certain way, and I think it's a way that many people who really, you know, many of the kinds of people who attend FedSoc events, many liberty-oriented people can fall into in thinking about freedom of speech. The reason why I think some of these blessings have also been a curse is that the instrumentalism of utilitarianism cannot sustain a right to freedom of speech. All that such consequentialist arguments get you is a permission, conditional. You may speak as long as you have something useful to say, right? Which sounds just like that Brian Leiter article that I was quoting. It leaves a firm foothold for restrictions on speech that the government deems not very helpful, which it increasingly invokes to silence voices that some find offensive or too divisive or too far from the mainstream. The utilitarian case is seductive, I think, in part because it's a relatively easy case to make. It's much easier to show the practical benefits of open inquiry, which are real and which are profound historically, right? It's much easier to show these practical benefits. of how historical discoveries in the sciences, among other areas, have been propelled by the candid airing of clashing views than it is to adopt the alternative defense, explaining, along with John Milton and John Locke and others, the futility of force, the inability of physical power, the tools of the magistrate, as they talk about it, guns, clubs, handcuffs, the kinds of things our governors use, right? It's a lot easier to explain the Millian benefits than it is to explain the Lockean impossibility of using physical tools to change a man's mind, to change a man's thinking, and to talk about the value of a person's doing his own thinking. All of that, that kind of Milton-Locke line, that requires a much deeper dive into the nature of reason and choice and beliefs. But so I think that's part of why, well, you know, it's so easy to make this case, the utilitarian case. Problem. In fact, your right to free speech doesn't depend on the social utility of what you have to say. And the utilitarian case is actually merely a case, again, for some speaking, for socially useful speaking, rather than for anybody's title to speak. The more Enlightenment view, again, the Locke-Miltonian view, by contrast, recognizes that your life is yours. And you're entitled to lead it however you please, speaking or not, whether you have worthwhile things to say or not. Speaking is simply one way of exercising your general freedom of action. The single question for the government to ask of any specific speech is, does it infringe on others' rights? That's all that should matter to how the government should treat it. So here, the upshot. Defenders of free speech have been in thrall. And so defenders, people who I think are good guys, right? Yeah, I'm on their side. But I do think most defenders of free speech have been enthralled to utilitarianism because it offers a good defense of speech, of robust dialogue, which is tremendously valuable. But it doesn't support freedom of speech. It doesn't justify rights to free speech. When rights live by utility, they tend to die by utility. Okay. In closing, let me say two things, two points in closing. First, and this harps back to something I said a little bit earlier, even while I have insisted on precise usage in assigning these four terms, I do want to underscore the importance of other normative standards that still apply to a person's speech besides its freedom, right? Questions of freedom and, is it free or is it censorship? Those questions are important, but they don't exhaust the field of critical appraisal. So we should defend freedom of speech. We should be careful to understand exactly what that means and what it doesn't mean. But we should then also be prepared to condemn speech that is immoral, evil, completely irrational, completely destructive, and so on, right? Defend the racist's right to speak, but explain what the hell is wrong with the idiocy that he's spouting, okay? And I think we too often hide behind, well, he's got the right to say it, which he does. We then retreat into not actually addressing and explaining to some people who still need the explanations of what's wrong with the substance of what a person says, okay? So I in no way mean to be minimizing the significance of that. I'm just saying that's a different issue from the freedom of speech, where your speech stands vis-a-vis the legal system. Okay. Secondly, finally, a reminder of the stakes. I've called attention to four concepts that those debating freedom of speech typically use either equivocally or simply inaccurately. And while these can initially seem innocuous, peripheral to the meaty or disputes, their misuse is more consequential than we suppose. How we categorize things, is this right absolute? Is that action censorship? How we categorize these things directly determines how the government uses force and what restrictions we think it has the authority to impose. So again, mislabeling leads to mistreating. by lending the aura of respectability to illegitimate government restrictions, we soften people's resistance, and I think individuals' freedom is progressively, steadily suffocated. So I do think we have reason to worry here. Okay, we have some time for questions. So if they're going to bring out a microphone, if anybody has questions, happy to take a few. So if you would step up to the mic to ask your question, and I'll step away because I think I can see you better from over here. So feel free. And you can hear me, I'm on, right?
Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
Good, okay, hi.
Hi, I wish that's working. So you differentiated between censorship from the government and censorship from a private party. And I know that in your article, you talk about employment as a contract that you enter into, and there's, you know, certain concessions because of that. But what if your employer, you know, is the government and speech is restricted in that sense? Is that a limit on free speech, or is that something else?
Okay, that's a good, interesting question. If the employer is the government, first I should say, I haven't thought that all the way through, okay, that kind of thing. But if it's government, it is different. However, I think there can, because it's the government saying you can't say those things, Tara, right? But insofar as it's an employment relationship, I don't have to work for the government. I could try to get a job, you know, I could try to be employed by some private organization and so on, right? But if I choose this job, then as with any job, I choose it on the terms that are offered and I agree or not. Now, typically you like some of the terms, you don't like others. You wish you had longer vacations or whatever. But if I agree to it, I can't then complain that, you know, unless a gun was put to my head to agree to it. So again, insofar as it's an employment relationship, nobody has to work for the government. If you choose to, you are subject to their restrictions, just as you would be the restrictions of a private employer. However, I think there's a little bit, at least a little bit more to say. There's probably a lot more to think about here, but there's at least a little bit more. The government, in doing anything that it does and everything that it does not have the same discretion properly as a private organization, right? The government is spending our money, and it exists for a specific purpose, to protect our rights. So everything that it does has got to be geared around what's the best way, the most effective and efficient way we can do that. So it would be, you know, for it to then come up with some speech codes that it put on its workers in this area, you know, in the Defense Department or in the post office or whatever it might be, right? Well, unless those speech codes had some actually legitimate rationale in the effective functioning of that particular office of government, it would be a complete abuse of its authority, right? So, I mean, there are reasons for which it shouldn't have codes. There are conceivable circumstances in which it might be that it should restrict its employees' vocabulary on the job, let's say, in certain kinds of sensitive offices and so on. So it does get a little bit more, you know, there's a little bit more to it there. It's an interesting kind of case that you raise. Leave it at that. Other questions?
Hi.
Hi.
So unfortunately, I have not read your article yet, so I apologize if this question.
That's good, because then I can just say, oh, it's all in there.
Great.
See, thank you.
So I'm kind of wondering how much some of your argument is premised on maybe a negative conception of liberty. Like Hayek or Berlin, because I'm looking at, for example, G here. You say, like, confusion of freedom to do something with the ability to do that thing. And I might say, well, yeah, if you believe in negative liberty, then that's right. But if you're a positive liberty person, then you say, well, no, that G is not a confusion. G is an accurate statement. So
yeah.
I just kind of wonder how much is that, like, baked in or important?
It's baked in.
Okay.
It's definitely baked in. And you know, at the very beginning of the talk, I said something. I mentioned a few presuppositions, and I probably didn't mention all the presuppositions. But I'm definitely coming from, and you're completely right. You know, to pick up on this, I'm definitely coming from a certain understanding of what freedom in general is, or you know, freedom vis-a-vis the government, political freedom, legal freedom, that kind of freedom, right? You know, to then just have a paper on freedom of speech, I'm trying to understand freedom in a certain way, and I am. I will say, I am sorry if I'm offending people here. Well, I'm not that sorry if I'm offending you. I'm sorry if you disagree with me and think this is
well, I'm sorry if you disagree with me, but I have never understood so-called positive liberty. I've tried. I really don't understand how it can work. But that's another, I don't know, another discussion or another, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Other questions? Good.
A lot of your talk has proceeded on the another assumption that speech and meaning are coextensive, that is, that meaning is or always will be easy to identify. How would, and the law does the same thing, how would the analysis be different for things like implications or connotations or even something like implicatures? I guess the idea being, does the government have license to go a little further in restricting speech on the grounds that speech may not, that meaning may not always be easy to capture if it's not denotative?
That's an interesting question, but I'm not fully sure that I get it because I'm not sure of why you think that I was implying that speech is always, you know, always the meaning of speech is always just kind of apparent on its face, self-evident. I don't think that. I certainly think that, yes, yeah, sometimes what somebody is saying, ooh, not quite sure what they mean, or, but I'm not sure what in my paper made you think that I would deny that, or if, so is there something?
I'm sorry, I should also say, I haven't read the paper yet.
Sure, no, but I mean, just in the talk, I'm not sure why you think that I would think that the meaning of speech has always got to be clear. I do think there are cases where even there'll be, I mean, I don't think, also, let me just add something else. I don't think, man, if you buy my view, then all the hard problems dissolve and the waters part and you can go home early. No, I mean, I do think there are still hard cases for the government, including, you know, well, this gets a lot more complicated, but I definitely think there will still be some hard cases. But I think those are compounded when we work under these conceptual confusions that we're not even using the terms free or censorship in a consistent way and in a logical way. But that's another thing. But anything more on this thought of, yeah?
Sure, yeah. And I wasn't trying to say that you know, had a wrong assumption or anything. I just was hoping you might comment further on does the law in particular tend to assume that meaning is always clear?
I don't think so at all. Or certainly when you think about judicial review and the kinds of cases that do become the controversial cases where, gee, there seem to be reasonable grounds for interpreting just the law itself. What was the case that they were hearing yesterday about a tire, right? I don't mean tires on your car. I mean what you wear. Just yesterday, wasn't it, that the Supreme Court was hearing this case about some law in Minnesota about what you could wear to the polling place. And there are questions about, you know, and that's exactly, it fits in with the sort of thing I was talking about, right? Well, is that saying something when you wear a t-shirt that says Me Too or that says All Lives Matter or Black Lives Matter or it's the text of the First Amendment or it's the text of the Second Amendment? And what does it mean? And is that political speech or not? I mean, there are some interesting questions that the answers to them are not at all self-evident in cases like that, right? And I think in many other cases, you know, is he just talking or is that part of a real plan to commit a crime? I mean, think about incitement, think about threats, think about, you know, they're issued through, I mean, a threat is issued in words, but when is it a threat and when is it just a sort of ominous, I mean, the law has had to try to figure out some boundaries here, and I definitely think that there are hard questions there. I don't think they're insoluble questions, but, so I don't mean to oversimplify the work of the law or say that the law has to take a simplistic view of meaning. Part of what's important, I think, about paying attention to context, which I do think is very important, is that that can matter a lot to exactly what is meant by the very same words. So different situations with different audiences, you say raise the roof, and sometimes you mean, you know, well, I'm telling my construction workers what to do. And sometimes I'm saying, yeah, you're going to have a set like this. You need to do something about it. Raise the roof. Sorry, pathetic. Other questions? Yes.
is there such a thing as a non-absolute right?
Oh man, that's a good question, an interesting question. In the sense that, I mean, I'm speaking, and this was something I didn't refer to at all, but I'm definitely, what I have in mind are natural rights that then the government, the law, legal system should respect, right? Or should protect, not just respect, protect. We can make an agreement with some conditions involved, such that I would have a right maybe to your performance of mowing my lawn or painting my house on certain conditions, you know, such that it would be a conditional right and I've got to live up to my end of the bargain and so on. So sort of individually created rights and responsibilities, I think, can certainly have conditions. We can also think about conditions in the sense that a person might do things that would forfeit some of his natural or originally absolute rights. So that's a good, I need to think about that more. Because I could see that being requiring a little more qualification of some of what I said about absolute.
I mean, I'm wondering, you know, the difference between a condition or an exception and a boundary.
Well, so here, I guess the bigger picture that I really am concerned with is when we're not careful about using the term exception, we'll tend to say, well, that's, you know, there are always exceptions, because we say that in all sorts of, not just about the law, right? People love to say, well, there are always exceptions. And we tend not to pay close attention then to, well, when should a so-called exception be made, or when would it be legitimate and when would it not be legitimate? So let's come back to some of the kinds of cases that arose here, right, where people will say, you should have the right to free speech, but you shouldn't be free to libel people or fraudulently misrepresent the car that you're selling them and so, or divulge national security. And I agree. But are those exceptions or not? What, you know, I agree. Why do I agree? That's the conversation that's got to be had, that people have to understand. Here is why libel should be treated differently, and here is why the sheer writing of a political tract by Karl Marx or somebody who you might consider, oh my God, ominous and so on, why that's different from actually plotting a crime. We've got to look into those differences so that we maintain the proper standards for knowing what speech should be free, freely allowed, not restricted by government, and what shouldn't be. But when we just kind of throw them all into these, we have these couple of catch-all categories, nothing's absolute, always exceptions, how convenient and how lazy our thinking tends to be, such that, well, then somebody says, well, come on, this should be an exception. And if you don't have any understanding of why the law should treat libelous or fraudulent speech differently, you have no basis on which to say, no, that's not a good exception. So that's the bigger picture background that's informing my concern about let's clean up some of these. And I should say, I have ideas on why, I definitely have ideas about why I think libel should be treated differently and fraud and so on. But I also respect that there are some hard questions within those lanes that need to be answered. Yeah. Thanks. Time for one or two more, I think. Anybody?
I have a question for you. So you talked about the scope of free speech being, I guess, the point where it starts hurting other people. But what if the injury isn't very concrete or individualized? And kind of an example you mentioned, like, briefly in your talk, and just something that came to mind is, like, you know, distributing child pornography. Oh. Like, it's, I mean, I think that hurts society as a whole for sure, but it's not a very concrete and particularized injury. Right. And so how do you justify, I mean, is that government censorship, you know, forbidding that? Can we say that that is not free speech because it's hurting society as a whole? And then where would that line be?
Okay, a couple of things. And I didn't, speech should be free, you have a right to say whatever you want, up to the point, I didn't say of harming other people or something even close to that, of infringing on their freedom, infringing on their rights. And here again is a case where I do think John Stuart Mill is misleadingly vague, because he is famous for advocacy of the harm principle in general, not just in regard to free speech or free expression, but in general, Mill says, you should be free to do anything up to the point at which you harm others. Well, harm is a very capacious term. You can be harmed. He broke up with me after 2 years. There's a real sense. I mean, she's really having a hard time for the, right? I mean, there are all sorts of ways, which I won't bore you with, but there are all sorts of ways in which one might reasonably be said to be harmed by the activities of others. The subset of harms that I think is the proper role of the government to police is infringements on our freedom. Now, again, that's going to require, and this is something I've done in some other work, but a definite picture of freedom and why we have rights to freedom and so on. So just to say a word on the pornography case that you raised, because it's very interesting and it's actually related to a paper I'm working on currently on the speech action distinction, but I've also been reading a lot of arguments about hate speech. And I do think I definitely oppose restrictions on so-called hate speech, but I think one of the better arguments for such restrictions, better at least in some respects, are those arguments that try to appeal to harm to the body politic, let's say, or society as a whole. But there are a few problems there, and I think you yourself already referred to at least one of them, which is, sympathetic as we might be with the idea, gee, this pornography, apart from being disgusting, at least, sorry, that's my take, may have deleterious effects on the way men think about women, or depending on the pornography, I guess, on other things. Lots of things may have deleterious effects, right? It's what's the principle, and that's where you were going, which I think is what you've always got to ask about these things. You've got to elevate the perspective from, oh, that's really nasty speech, or that may do some bad stuff, right? You've got to elevate it to, would it do bad stuff of the sort that's the government's job to care about? Government's job is not to make us all nice people or moral people. It's to make us respect one another's rights. Now, there's a lot of other work for a lot of other of us to do about how to be nice people or moral people and all that, but that's not the government's job. And again, the kind of principle that one would be operating on in, well, this will harm society. There are a lot of books in my office that I think the reading of which would, if people really took these books seriously and believed them, would have very harmful effects. I don't think that's an argument for people should not be able to read these, right? And part of the reasoning there is that the only way to figure out what the hell is true or right is through reading all sorts of ideas on what the hell is true or right, including the most foul and disgust and so on. But if you can show, I'm always open to it, but if you can show in a given case this person, this individual, or these individuals suffered demonstrable material harm as a result of what he was saying, be it pornographic or libelous in a genuine case of whatever, okay, then we've got a legal case to have. But I do think you have to show that kind of particularized harm.
Thank you.
Sure. And let me say, I think the questions just indicate, there's a lot of hard stuff to be, to be still sorted out here, I think. Anyone else? One more? Okay, then I think I'll thank you very much and go back to the nice, bright Austin day. All right.